What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardware, this week joined by Podcast Producer Ben Ellman. Hey, Ben.
Good morning and Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year. It does feel like, I don't know, a year's worth of news has happened in between the last few episodes. Good God.
Yeah.
But yeah, we are here, 2026. We're here. We're doing a live stream. Igor Bonifacek from Engadget is going to join us in a bit to talk about, I think, the main topic of this episode. That's going to be Apple choosing Google's Gemini to power its next-gen Siri and foundation models. That's going to be a big discussion within this episode. But hey, some news broke this morning as we were preparing this podcast. So Igor's off writing news. We're going to start with some other stories. And there's a bunch of big stuff. A lot has happened, even though CES is over. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcastengadget.com. I would love to see more emails going into the new year. How are you liking the show? What would you like to see? What topics would you like us to cover? And as always, if you send us a good question, that could be part of our Asking Gadget feature on the website, too. So you could actually get written up and be in the podcast. That's a fun time. Ben, how is 2026 treating you?
So far, 2026 is actually treating me really well. Mm-hmm. It feels a little scary to say that.
As long as you don't look at the news, like just locally.
Personally, yes. It's going well for me. And then I turn on my phone and it's like a portal to the hell dimension.
It's really bad.
Because the news is very scary. Yeah.
Being at CES and being like in our bubble of just like all tech news, like to look up occasionally and just see how bad things were getting. Hey, things are pretty bad around America, and I'm hoping 2026 shapes up better. But man, I don't know. Do what you can to stay sane, folks, and maybe melt some ice while you can. We'll be talking about some news first, some of our other news, and then Igor's going to join us to talk about AI-related stuff because he's our resident AI reporter. Specifically, I want to start off with Meta starting its Reality Labs layoffs. This is something that was rumored back in December. And as of this week, over 1,000 employees from its Reality Labs division, which I believe had like 10,000 plus employees, a lot of people are being laid off. And the entire company is basically being redirected, repositioned away from AR, VR stuff and more towards, AI-powered hardware, which could be a bit of AR. Basically, more of what we're seeing from their smart glasses, the Ray-Ban Meta glasses, and also the Ray-Ban display, the one with the little screen. We're going to be seeing more of that, maybe less VR. This is not surprising, because it's not like VR has really blown up. As much as I dislike Meta as a company, they poured a lot of money into Reality Labs. I believe they have lost over $70 billion in Reality Labs since the beginning of 2021. Their hardware is good. I think the Quest 3 is a fantastic piece of consumer hardware, but it's not making money. It doesn't have a huge
market. Hold on. Yes. Can you say that number again? Is that $70 billion?
That's nothing. That's chump change. But, they poured a lot of money into VR, and certainly Mark Zuckerberg was big on the metaverse as well as part of this whole thing. That's why he renamed the company to Meta in 2021. Turns out, wasn't really the metaverse that was the next big thing. It was like the AI push, and now they're trying to move more towards that. There's a statement from Andrew Bosworth, the CTO of Meta. They're saying, here's a quote here, "With the larger potential user base and fastest growth rate today, we are shifting teams and resources almost exclusively to mobile to continue to accelerate adoption there." And that's specifically mobile devices using AI, like the Ray-Ban hardware. He says, like, the VR division will operate as a leaner, flatter organization. So, I would not expect any new VR headsets soon. They already also killed a couple studios, I believe. They closed 3 VR studios. They also announced that Supernatural, that fitness app, is not going to be getting more content. So that thing is essentially dead, because that's a subscription product, and you're not going to pay a subscription for something, where you're not getting more content. So this is Meta shifting towards AI, more towards the glasses. Like I said, not too surprising. I've reviewed all the VR headsets. I understand like why the VR market hasn't taken off is because it's even with something that's wireless and fairly inexpensive and, easy to wear, like the Quest 3, it's still a big-ass thing in your head that isolates you from the world, and it really limits the market for those types of things. Do you find any of this surprising, Ben?
No, I'm still trying to figure out how much of this is we put a lot of effort and $70 billion worth of investment into it.
You got to burn money to make money.
Come up with some legitimate tech bottlenecks and dead ends, mm-hmm. and the technology isn't there yet, and all of that stuff. How much of it is that? Mm-hmm. And then how much of it is Mark Zuckerberg being the king of Facebook saying, hey guys, I'm really into the metaverse right now. Let's just go all in on the metaverse. And then he is chasing this next wave.
It's part of that.
If you were to assign percentages, mm-hmm. what percentage would you say VR is a dead end right now? And what percentage is Zuckerberg is chasing whatever he wants to?
I wouldn't say VR is a dead end, but there's a quote I like from Halt and Catch Fire, which if you like technology, you like computers, you should go watch that show because it's kind of a dramatized version of the early PC world from the 80s, like the Dell world, the people in Texas building computers. But there's a saying there, this isn't the thing, this is the thing that gets you to the thing. Right, VR was never going to be the next major platform for computing, but all of that technology, all that work that Meta did, put them in a great place to make those Meta Ray-Ban glasses and puts them in a really good place to do smart glasses, which is what people are really looking towards right now. So VR, yeah, as a headset, as a thing that's an isolated market, sure, kind of a dead end, sure. There are a lot of great VR experiences out there. I think the Quest 3S, which is cheaper, you get that thing, you can have some incredible experiences. There are things you can experience in VR that I can't even, it's like, people are trying to simulate, like, what does a 4D object look like, right, in 3D space? And there are examples of that, and it's like, it's hard to wrap your mind around that. And I think VR for a lot of people is the same way. Unless you, like, live through some of the best VR experiences, play through all of Half-Life Alyx in VR, then you see the potential of that platform, but also you see the downsides, that the comfort of it is tough. The convenience isn't great to play Half-Life Alyx. You also need a gaming PC in addition to VR hardware. It's complicated. It's complex. It's not as easy as just like whipping out your smartphone and getting on social media or something. So the rush now is to like get some of that great technology that was in VR, especially the headset stuff and the display stuff, and boil it down to something that is more accessible. I still don't think smart glasses are the thing. Actually, at CES, I got to try out the Meta Ray-Ban display for the first time. So that's the one with the little screen in it. And it has the wristband that you do gestures with. And it felt so weird, right? Like, the glasses feel fine. They feel like oversized hipster frames. The display looked good, but I really didn't like the wrist strap because it has, like, you can use finger gestures and all sorts of taps to control it. But it feels really weird. It feels really alien. Like, you're not doing anything anybody else in the room is doing. So they're trying to sell that thing as a way to, like, stay connected with other people. And to me, it just isolates us more from people who don't use that level of technology. So I'm iffy about those, even though the tech works well. The display looked cool. I think we are seeing a big push back towards slow tech. Mindful tech, right? And we're seeing people trying to,
at least that's what you want.
That's what you want. But there is a trend. People are selling like the phone you take away that's just like a dumb phone, right? That isn't the full capabilities of your smartphone. Or people are,
I have a friend who's a dumb phone connoisseur. Yeah. Like, he was majoring in psychology when we were in college. I think everybody was pretty firmly split, mm-hmm. between like the folks that had iPhones and the folks that had dumb phones, because smartphone adoption had not reached like ubiquity.
That was like 05 to 09 era right there, right? What was your college era?
I'm talking about like kind of candy bar,
yes.
Form factor smartphones.
But so, time frame, because that matters quite a bit. What years were you?
Yeah, the time frame would, let's say, 09 to like 13 or so.
Oh, really? Okay, so that was like enough into the iPhone era where things were cheaper. Like the iPhone 3GS, I think, was the big turning point where that was third gen. and it had gotten cheaper, more capable.
Well, yes, yeah. But you have to think that, like, a bunch of people are sending their children to this small liberal arts college that is exorbitantly expensive. So maybe what they want to do is save a little bit of money and not have a data plan, because SMS was a bigger thing. Whatever it is. Yeah. So, like, this friend is a dumb phone connoisseur because he started reading some of the early psychological research about smartphones and how they can be addictive. And he's like, you know what? I am just entirely opting out of that. Mm-hmm. That also gets to a kind of like sociological, like user behavior sort of question of, you know, during the early smartphone era, even in the like BlackBerry era, there was what my dad would call BlackBerry prayer circles, somebody takes their smartphone out and then everybody else takes their smartphone out, in the same way as, you know, if it was the 50s and people were smoking in the office, one person lights a cigarette, then everybody else lights a cigarette. Is there necessarily the same sort of sociological thing if everybody has the big hipster frames and they're constantly doing these little micro gestures? You know, like somebody pulling their phone out and then everybody pulls their phone out is more of a powerful draw to, I don't know, use this new technology, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I just don't see the widespread adoption that I think a lot of people are predicting. I see specialized use cases for these things. Like if I'm sitting at work and I want to put on something like my X-Real glasses or something and like have a giant screen to see my computer screen or just like watch a movie in private, that's great. But walking around the world with a smart screen, I feel like I'm actively like just trying to push against that, especially because we've seen what smartphone addiction can do to people, what social media addiction can do to people. The way I use my smartphone, like I try not to be on it all the time, especially when I'm out and about in the world. If I'm at a restaurant or something with my family, with my kids or friends, like, we're not pulling out our phones, or at least I'm not pulling out my phone. I'm trying to encourage other people not to do that, too. What is interesting is we're already seeing the societal pushback against smart glasses, especially as like surveillance devices. And that is interesting. Like we're clocking, we have the memory of what happens with smartphones. We see the potential dangers of like widespread panopticon, you know, especially tied to a social media company that is inherently kind of dangerous. And I think people are like pushing back and they're not really interested in it. So we will see. I don't know how any of this ends up.
Speaking of the panopticon.
Yes.
Gemini can now pull context from the rest of your Google apps for personalized intelligence.
It can. But we'll talk about this with
like larger Gemini integrations into all sorts of G Suite things, because I mean, now Google is very much announcing and saying, "Hey everybody, we're putting Gemini in Gmail, just so you know." And having read the big book that Steve Levy wrote about the development of Google, mm-hmm. and you know its first 5 or 10 years as a company, it reminds me of the controversy where people didn't quite understand how Google was doing their ads. And so having Gmail ads that were based on the context of your emails, but they weren't necessarily being read by humans in order to place those ads. I'm thinking that somebody in Google has a long enough institutional memory to say, hey, let's make sure that people don't freak out about this again.
I mean, probably. The thing is, like, we'll talk about this around what Apple originally announced for its next generation Siri, but it's basically this. Like, if the AI stuff is going to be useful, it's going to be useful because it knows more about us. So I'm honestly surprised it took Google this long to start like integrating the other apps, but this is how you can make something like Gemini useful, right? Like, I don't want Gemini or AI search to replace actual internet search, which is what's happening. But if I could be like, hey, what is that thing I owe to somebody? You know, what did they ask for? Or where is this? Where do I need to go for this birthday party? If you could just ask conversational questions to AI about your massive inbox or your like unorganized pile of tasks, I think a lot of people appreciate that. But it's also Google. And yes, Google has monetized everything. I don't know how this is going to tie into anything. I will tell you, I do miss the days of like traditional Google search, but also occasionally when I'm researching things, like, it is helpful to be like, okay, I'll be like, okay, fine. Gemini, make me a chart of this stupid thing. And then I go look at the chart and then I start clicking links to like double check mm-hmm. data and stuff. So mm-hmm. like there is value in something like that, but you know, I don't know how much I want to give over my my life or my internet technology life to these AI services. How do you feel about this, Ben?
We've got an interesting comment in the chat by DPro9, who says, think of AI as your mental butler. And I think that's where some of the friction is for me, that I don't want to give up too much stuff to the extended mind. I actually took a class about this mm-hmm. in college. Like human and technology sort of stuff. And in that class, they talked about how like the extended mind has always kind of existed. The example that they gave was actually often that wives are their husband's social secretaries.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is some like worth in making sure that you remember something on your own. It builds neural connections. Everybody go back and listen to the interview that we had with Eric Mijakovsky mm-hmm. from Pebble, because he talked about how before Pebble had this AI ring thing where you press a button and it takes a voice note, basically, he would have an idea and then he would just say it to himself over and over again and, you know, maybe try to like come up with some kind of mnemonic or I don't know, like that's just how people remember things. And there is definitely some like worth to doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you got to exercise your brain. I think this is a thing like as society is shifting, I think this is a thing like, hey, as you get older, you should probably be doing those monk stretches.
You should be doing the crosswords and the Sudoku.
Well, you should be doing the crosswords.
Anything that exercises your brain,
your body. You have to move like. My back hurts a lot because I often don't move and stretch enough. And there is functionally like, there's a
possibly also a weak core too.
It's everything, but it's also you have to exercise it. And turns out like a lot of civilizations have done things to do this. You see older Chinese folks just like swinging their arms and doing stretches in the park. That's why, because this is a thing that people have known about for a very long time and have come up with ways to counteract that, to stay limber. And we're going to have to do the same for our brains. It's going to be Sudoku. It's going to be memory things. At the same time, it will be useful because that extra work of like relying on your partner, who is, if for a man, it's usually their wife, who there's a saying behind every great man, there's a great woman, yada, yada, yada. But it's also they don't get as much publicity because they're doing this lower level background work. And they don't get the glory. And it would be cool if we could have ways to set up technological help for those respects. So it's one of those things we're gonna have to deal with, but I don't know, to me this is one of the better aspects of going into Gemini and using these AI tools. Yeah, let us know how you feel about this. Would you rather have more personalized AI, or would you rather have just something that's like being like Gemini or Copilot Search and just like breaking down the web for you? To me, I think AI becomes more useful as it becomes more personal, and is less cloud connected and maybe less tied to other services or companies. Like if it's running on devices you have, especially as our devices become more functional with better MPUs, that's more useful to me. But yeah, we will see. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We're also seeing a bunch of news. I wrote about like after CS that it seems like the PC industry is going to have a bad year. Because what has happened is that the entire AI industry is gobbling up all the RAM. In fact, not just buying all the RAM available now, but buying RAM into the future, RAM that has not even been built yet, is being allocated for the massive AI servers coming from NVIDIA and AMD. And hey, as part of that, we saw the news this week that Framework is increasing the price of its desktop by $460 due to the RAM crisis.
$460 the average person is a whole lot.
Yep. That's, I mean, is a whole lot. And also, those things did not start cheap. They started at like $1,100, $1,139 for the 32 gigabyte Framework desktop. And this thing's also kind of interesting because it's running that Ryzen AI Max APU, the thing that has the processor, the GPU, and memory like baked into a single chip. So those are even like, I think, harder to deal with because it's not just like RAM that you can upgrade down the line. You have to get the RAM that you want for the framework desktop when you buy it. There is no upgrading down the line unless you upgrade the whole chip. So anyway, that's going to be more expensive. We saw,
and I was saying before we started recording and like in pre-production stuff that this is the sort of thing that can kill smaller companies. Mm-hmm. It would be really sad to see all of these smaller PC manufacturers that are quote unquote at the margins end up dying because they can't keep up with the gargantuan orders for RAM or video cards like it was like almost 10 years ago.
Not 10, it was only a couple of years ago for the video cards, but yeah. That was it was a whole bunch of things. But yes, you're right. I don't want to see these smaller manufacturers go away. It's already hard to be a hardware company, especially one that's not huge. So this is going to make life even more difficult. It's also been difficult with like all the random tariff stuff, the random like economic insanity happening over the last year or two. None of it is easy. So for all those reasons, it's going to be tough to be a young, new hardware company. Yeah.
Tom Rogers in the chat says, $460 is my entire laptop budget.
You know, hey, you can get a good laptop for that price now. So my mantra going into 2026, folks, as I discussed with Ed Zitron on their podcast during CS, buy used, buy refurbished. Buy used, buy refurbished. Do not look at new hardware. Do not be tempted by the shiny new. It's going to be a tough year. If you're building a new PC, good luck, man. It's rough out there. And kind of
go to those auction sites for like institutional surplus because that is fantastic.
Maybe people are also seeing like go to stores that are kind of clueless. So like Walmart occasionally has like PC hardware in stock and will just like misprice it. Costco, if you have a Micro Center around, like occasionally people see deals in stores. I have a Micro Center near me. I should probably visit it and see what's going on over there. Related to all this, by the way, there was a rumor that NVIDIA may be bringing back its 3060 GPU. And we're also seeing a story as of today, this morning, actually, that's what Igor is working on, is that NVIDIA is killing off the RTX 5070 Ti and potentially the RTX 5060 Ti as well, because they have a lot of VRAM. And the VRAM, RAM in general, is stuff that's going to be hard to find moving forward. This is just so weird. This is weird because we don't really see an era where newer products are being shut down because they can't be built given the hardware available. And older products are coming back. The 3060 can come back because it's running older RAM, which is less in demand. So it's easier for NVIDIA to build those cards. And if you look at like the Steam list of popular hardware, like the general hardware consensus on Steam, the 3060 is one of the more popular cards right now. Like people are still using that to play games because they're not everybody's pumping to 4K or super high frame rates. So it makes sense for them to start building those again.
Then we also saw the news that Apple is starting to bundle its creative apps like Final Cut Pro and Logic into a single subscription. I don't know how to feel about this because
they're doing the Adobe, like, man. Everyone's doing.
Yeah, I don't like software as a service, yeah, which makes me very unpopular. It's not that like the average user loves software as a service, but the industry loves SaaS so much. Like, have you ever seen the salary estimates for SaaS institutional salespeople?
Sure. Yeah.
There's some. They start at like $250 and they go to seven figures.
Because it's just like infinite money for these companies. And like as a consumer, there is some short-term benefit, right? Because like a lot of these things, it's hundreds of dollars if you wanted all these things all together. So paying $13 a month or $129 a year to have access to Final Cut Pro, Logic Pro, Pixelmator Pro, Motion Compressor, and Main Stage, like all together, that's a pretty good deal. The problem is when you're several years down the line paying that fee over and over again, then it's like, oh, you never actually own the software. You're just like basically renting it infinitely. The advantage there is like in a couple of years when a new version comes out, you're just still renting, right? You don't have to buy a whole new thing. I think for some pros, it just kind of evens out. But I think for the more casual users, I don't know. That's where, like, I think a subscription is actually better. But then if you're using it long term, it's worse for you. It's a weird graph of how useful this is. Yeah.
The thing that I've heard from a lot of tech punks recently is the sentence, you'll own nothing and you'll enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And usually they're talking about, like, software as a service, or the fact that, like, you don't own physical copies of games or something. So if the store goes down, then you're not able to access it anymore. But it has also expanded to the idea of, like, private equity companies buying up single family homes and, like, all of this stuff of, like, you can't just purchase something once. I feel like my situation is a tiny bit better, mm-hmm. because the main audio platform, the main audio workstation that I use is Reaper, which is a flat fee for, you know, between X version and Y version.
Right, right. That's old school. That's how you used to buy software. Yeah.
Yeah. They call the Y version out, you know, very far in advance. So, you know, you'll get at least like 3 or 4 years of support, mm-hmm. when you're putting down however much money. It shouldn't be surprising that Reaper is developed by a bunch of the same people who did WinAmp, mm-hmm. though. Like, mm-hmm. they are just from a different era of software development.
It just feels good. Like, there's a couple of things where I bought licenses years ago, and I just, like, oh, I need to reinstall Total Recorder on Windows. Go into my email, pull the thing from 2012, take that key, plug it in, and it works. It just works, and that feels amazing. It does require more legwork. It's not like you're just going to an app store and hitting download again and restore your subscription or whatever, but it feels good. I do feel like the love of people going back to, like, cassette tapes, I don't get that at all, but the love of, like, owning a thing, vinyl, cassette tapes, CDs, I still see people going back to, like, talking more about buying those things. It feels better. It feels different when you're, like, doing it physically. Yeah.
So what are the main benefits to customers with a subscription model like this? Lucky Dog Podcasts wants to know. I think that's a good question.
I mean, it's just cheaper in the short term, right? It's cheap. If you're paying $13 a month, if you wanted all of those apps, it would be several hundred dollars upfront. And instead, the upfront cost
could be near $1,000,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, could be near, if you wanted every single thing in that bundle, versus just paying $13 and you just need to do a thing and then you're done. And even for the year, $129 is not that much money, but you have to, like, mentally consider that you are not, you don't own this thing, right? You can't just, like, install it on all your computers easily. You can't, you don't have, like, free reign to use it how you'd like. It is a subscription that is tied to your account, and they may limit, like, how many devices it can be, even be used on, stuff like that. There are limitations you give up or you have to accept to deal with the cheaper price, right?
Like, recently I was looking up to see if there was even a possibility of buying, like, a perpetual license for Adobe Premiere Pro. Mm-hmm. And of course you can't, it's Adobe. Mm-hmm. And two, there were some people online who were talking about how you used to be able to, but buying one of those licenses was, like, yeah, in the thousands, yes, of dollars.
Yes. So that's the push and pull. If you have the money and you were able to afford that, yeah, that was kind of cool. And then you could take that license and do with it what you will. But in a couple of years, you have to pay that money again to get the next version of the thing. Yeah.
I guess you could think of it in the kind of, like, MMORPG sense of that they're constantly doing maintenance and they're constantly building new features, which means that it would make sense for you to just be paying a subscription for all these rolling updates, mm-hmm. because if you buy the perpetual license for, you know, version X dot whatever, then you might stay stuck there. Mm-hmm.
Which is also something that happened with older software all the time. So, you know, it's not entirely evil, but I do think it can be used for evil depending on how companies deploy their subscriptions and user subscriptions and how much value they put into it. $13 a month to get all these Apple creative apps, that's not a big deal to me. Like, to me, I think this is going to do more good than harm for people, but we shall see. And kind of related to this, by the way, is Tesla's full self-driving feature, which, to be clear, is not fully self-driving, But before, you used to have to pay $8,000 up front. Actually, it used to be even more, as I recall. But it used to be a big upfront cost, and then it was a thing tied to your heart, tied to your Tesla car and your account. And now that's going to be a rolling subscription starting February 14th for $99 per month or $1,000 per year. And this is where I'm starting to be like, man, that is rough. Looking at companies who are really treating subscriptions badly, it's car companies, partially because to connect, to get new features to your car, they have to have like onboard cellular. So they're paying a cellular subscription fee that you don't really see. But that's part of it. That's why, like, for my Volvo, I'm paying a chunk of change to be able to remote start that thing and track where it is. For Teslas, it's a lot more for full self-driving. This is rough. This is a rough one. I'm not a huge fan of Tesla as a company and the guy behind it. But I do know a lot of people who own Teslas and who for years have used the full self-driving to drive thousands of miles on highways just fine. They're careful about it. They are aware it's not really full self-driving, but it is good enough to do like long distance road trips, and it works to a certain degree for them. So for them, they get value from paying for it. This subscription fee is so high. This is what's ridiculous to me.
The only mm-hmm. thing that would make me comfortable about full self-driving is, especially in a Tesla, is treating it like a slightly more...
Better cruise control?
Yeah, sophisticated cruise control.
That's what a lot of people are doing. That's what a lot of people are doing. And honestly, that's how I've lived with my recent cars. Like any car that has like adaptive cruise control, which is something 2015 and on, where the car is like just sensing the lane in front of you or the car in front of you, and it's keeping distance while you're in cruise control, that's great. The next level up is like having a bit of like lane control assistance. That's really great for road trips. So you're like not always fighting to keep your car straight. Like there it scales up from there. And among those features, it does seem like FSD works for a lot of people unless you're really dumb about it. And I saw people doing like they were doing their makeup or they were like eating breakfast or something while their Tesla was driving itself, and then they crashed.
People on their phones, people yeah. sleeping. Yeah, there have been a lot of videos that people have also taken from their not full self-driving cars. Hopefully it's the passengers, but let's be real, it's probably not, of other people like completely asleep in their Tesla as the Tesla is driving. It's nuts.
And it's also because Tesla sells it as full self-driving and Musk has like blown up the feature to be like, oh yeah, you could fully trust it, even though there are like multiple complaints against them, and the government was also trying to look deeper into like the lies around that stuff. So be smart, folks. Don't trust Elon Musk, and honestly, never put your life entirely in the hands of like an automated system. That seems bad. But then I don't know, now we're talking about robotaxis and Waymos and whatnot, but I guess what gives me a little more faith in those things is like, you look at a Waymo, it's got so many sensors. It's got sensors on every corner. There's the big ass thing on the top. It's like, okay, it's doing stuff. Whereas your Tesla, especially for newer Teslas that don't have the LiDAR, FSD is running on like camera, just the cameras and like visual processing. And I'm like, that's a lot you're pushing in there. So I don't know. Let us know what you also think about that. Do you own a Tesla, and would you pay the subscription fee for full self-driving? Did you pay the full fee to just own or to buy self-driving for your account? I'd love to know what people are thinking about this. And related to all the AI stuff we're seeing, I just want to shout this out quickly. Matthew McConaughey apparently is fighting unauthorized AI likenesses by trademarking himself. So that's one way to do it if you're a celebrity. This is to keep AI companies from stealing his likeness. He's filed trademark applications with the USPTO, and they're for video and audio clips featuring him staring, smiling, and talking. All right. I guess, all right, all right, all right. But don't sue me, Matthew McConaughey.
This is probably like a trial. Like, this is setting up legal precedent of, okay, I've like completely copyrighted myself or trademarked myself, let's see where this goes. And then there's going to end up being some kind of court case. It might not be with McConaughey, it could be with someone else, who knows.
I mean, I could certainly see people fighting it, just like Scarlett Johansson, like when Disney pushed their stuff to streaming, and she like sued Disney, right? She sued because that wasn't in their contract to lose theatrical screenings for those movies. So you are seeing celebrities kind of push back and fight back because these corporations are just like taking advantage of them in different ways. AI stuff is completely different because they're not essentially working for these companies, but this is why we need broader regulations around AI in general. And all this talk right now is like, just let AI have free reign in the market and take whatever they want. That's kind of where we're going. And it's honestly kind of sad. So we shall see. But good on Matthew McConaughey for this, I guess. All right, back to the main event of this episode. Senior reporter at Engadget, Igor Bonifacic, is joining us to talk about Apple picking Gemini to power its next generation Siri. What's up, Igor? How's it going?
Hey, Deb. Thanks so much for having me on the pod.
Happy to have you here, Igor. We saw this news this week, and I guess it became a big thing because everybody was waiting to see what Apple would do for its future AI. Would they expand their partnership with OpenAI, which is a thing right now? If you have Apple Intelligence on your device and you ask Siri something, it can send that command to OpenAI, and within the Siri interface, it'll get you back a response. So that's been the like smartest AI thing. But this week, Apple announced that Google's Gemini will be powering its next generation Apple Foundation model. So that includes the smarter Siri stuff that they previewed back in 2024 and also some of the original like ideas for Apple Intelligence. Any thoughts on this, Igor? Like, why did Apple stick with Google, who has been a partner for a long time because of Google Search?
Oh, so many thoughts. I think there is a part of it is better the enemy you know than the one you don't, right? And, you know, obviously, as you've stated, they have a longstanding relationship. And I don't think, I don't think this deal would have gone through if Trump had not become the president, if only because, you know, there's been so much scrutiny around this part, the search partnership specifically. So I think that's one part of it. But another part of it is that this to me would suggest that they don't think potentially that AI is as transformative as everyone else is making it out to be. Mm-hmm. Because, mm-hmm. you know, just for context, you know, when Apple has spent untold billions to wean itself off of Qualcomm for its 5G modems, right? Like going so far as to buy the division of Intel that they just spun off, right?
Yep.
And they stuck with that for years and years and years. And here they seem to be content to just turn to Google when, you know, this is something that I think clearly they like, you know, there is perhaps a tinge of mismanagement and like competing priorities at Apple, but clearly they have the resources to make this work, right? Like, and to make their own foundational models that can make a better Siri. But for whatever reason, they just decided, let's go with Google instead and Gemini.
Yeah, I feel like this is a time acceleration thing, right? Because, yeah, Apple has a ton of money, has a lot of smart people working for it. They have been like trying to build AI models for a very long time. But the thing we have learned is that this stuff is really a function of time and the data you're throwing at it. Like that was the key behind OpenAI with all of its GPT models, certainly with Gemini as well, which Google got a kick in the pants after the release of ChatGPT and Bing Chat and everything, and all that got really popular. So I do think like in time, Apple can figure it out and like entirely own their own model. But for right now, because everybody's looking at them and saying, hey, you're slow to AI, you're a dinosaur right now, get with it, Apple. They can just pull in Google and be like, hey, okay, fine, sure, we'll use some of their stuff for some better Apple Intelligence and the smarter Siri. And I think that just gets Apple to a point where they're at least competitive with what other platforms are offering right now. Because, yeah, if you have an Android phone, you've got a ton of Gemini-powered features, and you've got cool things that aren't easily available on iPhones because a lot of it's integrated in Android, and Android is so closely tied to Google in all of Google's services, right? So it just feels like a catch-up move to me.
Yeah, and I, you know, to your point, I do recall that there was reporting that, you know, one of the things that has been why this has been so slow is that it's just Apple's fundamental business model, or, you know, stated business model, where we respect your privacy and your data, is obviously it conflicts with how you build a at least quickly build a foundational AI model by harvesting as much data as possible, right? So I think this at least gets them around that for the time being. And I imagine, you know, like they're still working on all these things behind the scenes. Although friend of the pod, Mark Gurman had a pretty good, like, funny tweet about this, that like the previous, you know, head of Apple intelligence was collecting something like, you know, $10 million in salary, and which just got booted this week to be replaced by someone from Google.
Do you think this is a better partnership than like sticking with OpenAI or even Anthropic, which I think were part of the rumors? I feel like OpenAI is very volatile, and that's not something Apple tends to like. They like a stable partner and a partner they know, like Google. And Anthropic is just like a totally new thing to them.
Yeah.
And the thing that I was talking about with Devendra as we were planning this episode out was also a question of capacity. Like, you know that Google basically has infinite capacity.
Yeah, I think... So there are a couple things there, right? Like the easiest to start with is Anthropic, and I just simply don't think they have the models that Google, that Apple needs, right? Like Anthropic is kind of focused on different things like coding, right? Like you can't generate images with Claude. Not that this is, you know, part of the Siri suite, but I think, you know, like voice is not necessarily something that Anthropic is focusing on. The more interesting aspect of that is I think it goes back to what I said, which is Google is the safe bet, right? I think this is like, it's maybe not the coup de grace for OpenAI, but it is certainly like, I think, not a good sign, right? Because I think there's just not, I think, or sorry, let me, I think Apple has looked both at the models from Google and the ones from OpenAI, and they've come to the estimation that Google has the better one. Right. And the fact that Google is like a safe and secure company that has actual revenue and profit means it's here to stick around. Right. Whereas I think if Apple were to tie its ship to OpenAI, that would be a huge boon for OpenAI. But there's no, you know, like OpenAI is spending so much money to try to outscale Google, a company that just makes money, right? Yeah, so yeah.
They're not worried. OpenAI is worried about its existence, and Google is just like, hey, we're gonna pay more for AI, but we also have a legit business already.
Yeah. AI, like,
that's basically what I was saying.
Like AI is obviously, it infuses everything that Google does at this point, but it is just one of many things that it has that it's working on, right? And like it has businesses to support all of this work, which OpenAI can't say the same, right? So I think if there wasn't another code red at OpenAI this week, like I would really hope there's one going out, because they're just, you know, they're in a fight for their life, I think, at this point.
I should quickly, let's quickly go over like what Apple initially promised with its smarter Siri, because this was announced at WWDC in 2024. I was there with Sherlyn like when they announced this stuff, and it's a lot of it seemed cool. It was a Siri that can use apps for you, had personal details on you because it could access your mail and your calendar, and like it was all happening locally. So that privacy aspect that Google is pushing, like that was there at a time where people were sending sensitive data to OpenAI and Copilot and, you know, Gemini at the time too, or I don't even know if it was called Gemini by at 2024, but they were trying to do something different.
It might have been Bard.
Probably Bard at that point still, but it was a Siri that could basically help you. You could ask it questions about specific photos, like, hey, what's my driver license number? And ideally, Siri would be able to like look through the photos, find a license, your license, and get you that number. So it was a really smart and personalized form of Siri that they were talking about. And also a Siri that you could type to and that like just ask questions more directly to. Everything we're talking about, it's like if you had your own actual personal assistant, I feel like that's what Apple was selling to people. The drama happened when, it turns out at that WWDC, they did not show that off live. That was a pre-taped demo of just like, hey, what they expect to come. And then last year, last March, practically almost a year ago, Apple's like, oh no, that smarter Siri is delayed. It's not coming for a while. And that's kind of where we are. We're sitting waiting for it, which it's expected to arrive in spring of this year. I don't know if you have anything to add on that, Igor.
Yeah, only to say that, like, what they showed off was complete vaporware.
Yes.
Right? Like, you know, and the company has not really, you know, obviously companies are terrible at this for owning for their mistakes, but it has really never owned up to this, right? Like, the only reason we heard about the delay was because Gruber reached out to them, right? And they, like, really hesitantly gave him a comment, right?
They gave Gruber a full comment, which is something Apple never does.
Never does, right?
Yeah.
Also, famously, so they had ads promoting this, featuring Bella Ramsey from The Last of Us, right? Showing off these capabilities. And then they pulled these ads because, again, it was not a product that existed, right? Like, so, you know, I think this has just been, like, this is really just, like, I think the whole Siri saga, you know, starting from the beginning, is probably going to go down as the greatest fumble in Apple's history because they were first to this, right? And they could have had a stranglehold on it, but, you know, they allowed everyone else, you know, Google and Amazon, but mostly now Google, just to kind of take it and go with it.
But even Google, like Google, whose research division created the Transformer model, kind of underestimated the usefulness of like the consumer AI tools. And it was only, it was OpenAI because they, that's all they were focused on. They were laser focused on, initially created to build the AI to get us away from bad AI. But they were initially focused on building those AI models and creating something. It's, nobody could have predicted this. Like, even Google's caught flat-footed. They had to rush Bard out there. The initial demos of Bard were,
I mean,
a
it
mess.
Was because ChatGPT was not supposed to be as popular as it was.
Yeah.
They were just like, okay, let's like throw this out there for like a bunch of nerds and we'll like give it a very technical name, because who wants to use something that is like pre-trained Transformer?
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah.
That's confusing. And then it just like lit up because the search engines have gotten bad. And this is a better way of finding the collected knowledge on the internet.
It's Google shooting themselves in the foot by making search bad to optimize for ads, right? And their other revenue models. So it's a complicated soup. But what happened is a lot of people were caught flat-footed because OpenAI got good really quickly. I'm looking forward to seeing what a smarter Siri could look like. Ben, you brought up a good point. Like, when was the last time in big tech, like, has something that was, that's basically purely vaporware actually been announced? And the closest thing I can think of is like the weird time where everybody was really into crypto, right? Like game studios, Hollywood, people were talking about, oh yeah, we could have some sort of crypto thing we're working on, some sort of coin deal. Remember
or like a DAO for like the development of a game or something.
Remember the stupid apes? They were on Jimmy Fallon. Jimmy Fallon was out there pumping that thing. And then what happened is that a market was essentially nothing, but a couple of nerds got really rich because they basically leveraged whatever value there was there. So that was a whole like, that was a whole mess, but at least like, hey, Apple never touched it. And I think that was smart. I do want to say there are, for many reasons, I think Gadget, that's why we never touched it. And I do remember like talking to a lot of people, especially people in Silicon Valley in San Francisco, entrepreneurs I typically respect and doing interesting things are like, oh yeah, I'm working on this, this sort of like NFT crypto thing. I'm like, no, you aren't. Maybe you are, but maybe this is some sort of like clearly some sort of grift. And I think the most recent example,
in the same way that like in the Bay Area, if you say that you're a founder, that means that you're basically unemployed unless you have investment.
No, I've got VC backing.
If you're doing a crypto thing, especially if you are someone who had a startup that exited, you're just saying like, okay, yeah, I'm moving my peas around on my plate.
That's basically what it is. But the most recent example of this is Mr. Eric Adams, former mayor of New York City, launched a crypto thing immediately. And what happened? Within a day, pump
he's
and dump.
He's fighting anti-Semitism with crypto.
Pump and dump. Within a day, he's out of there, but he gained $1 million.
Mans did a rug pull, and he like the seat in Gracie Mansion, the mayor's office seat is still kind of warm with Eric Adams.
It was never warm. He was never there. He was never actually sitting there. He was out there always, like on flights to, where was it? Turkey or wherever?
Turkey.
But anyway, but that's the remnants of the crypto, is like instant grift. That's what it became. And I don't think, like, Apple never got involved in that. So I think AI is still kind of a grift. If you listen to, you know, the stuff from Mr. Ed Zitron and Better Offline, and a lot of people are reporting like how much of a grift this is, how much of like a circular economic engine that has developed around AI. NVIDIA.
I've sent people that diagram from Bloomberg of just like the circular investment so many times. And I'm like, eventually they're going to patch this infinite GDP exploit. Yeah. And when they do, it's bad.
It's gonna be bad. So sit tight and prepare for that, folks. I do kind of think like,
okay, but like, let's get a sentence answer. Is this Apple's biggest fumble? Igor.
Siri? I think so. Yes. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Devendra.
Yeah, I would say Siri from the beginning, though, the entire arc of Siri, not just the smarter Siri failure, but the entire arc of Siri announcing this thing was supposed to be a personal assistant, never quite lived up to it. And yeah, it's certainly one of Apple's biggest fumbles. Yeah.
Thank you for triggering my Siri.
Yeah, I'm keeping that in the final cut. So let's move on to some other AI news.
There's one thing I want to add here, because kind of tied to all of this, I do think this is part of what makes Apple working with Google kind of smart here, because if the AI industry crashes, they can just snip that integration with Gemini and get it out of there. And it doesn't, like, Apple doesn't crash and burn, but also Google will still exist too. Google can like mitigate.
Or they could just keep the service available to their users, because Google is not going to have the same kind of capital squeeze that a OpenAI or an Anthropic would. Again, they've built their businesses over like 25, 30 years.
That's what I'm saying. Google will be able to withstand any market hit, even if this integration, if AI falls apart entirely. So I think that's the big reason why Google is the safer bet here. But yes, there was some other news that was dropping and building up around CES, and that was the garbage happening around Grok and XAI and the CSAM and the generation of nudes from and or barely clothed people from video or from images. This was a whole mess. It took a very long time, basically took a month, for X to comment on this and saying, okay, we're going to turn this off. So yesterday there was a statement saying X says Grok will no longer edit images of real people into bikinis. It's going to push.
Oh, this is new information.
This is yesterday.
Very new.
They pushed all of Grok's image generation behind the subscriber paywall. So you have to pay to get that. They say they're going to like geofence.
Because for a little while, they just pushed it behind the paywall. And it wasn't just like you can't bikinify everyone.
They're also going to geoblock the ability of users to generate images of people in bikinis, underwear, and yada yada in regions where it's illegal. And tied to all this, I believe it was Indonesia and Malaysia completely blocked Grok because it was generating this stuff. What is wild to me is that this was essentially a CSAM generating machine and also a machine generating images of
unconsensual
images. It's a disgusting thing, and Elon Musk did not really see much of an issue with it. He did not really comment on it much. Igor, you're also, you know, you're our resident AI guy. How did this whole situation go down to you, and was it ridiculous for Grok to X to take so long to even address it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the takeaway from here is that we need to demand more from our governments, right? Mm-hmm, in Carissa's reporting, you know, this response came just hours after the Attorney General of California said they would investigate this, right? And so fundamentally, you know, like, not only are billionaires a front to, you know, just everything, but you can't have a democracy with billionaires, right? Because you have situations like this where he can just do whatever he wants because he has all the money in the world, right? And I think, you know, here in Canada, you know, our so-called minister of AI was like, oh, we're not going to do anything about it, right? Like, you know, and the UK, like, how long did they fumble that, right? Like, our Avery, one of our senior editors, she had a really great post about it, which is he could have just turned it off at any point, mm-hmm. right? Like, so
perfect Gawker headline from the Gizmodo alum.
And her post went up yesterday, like a couple hours before this announcement happened. So it almost feels like a response. Yeah.
So, I don't know what much else there is to say to that, other than there was like a really great comment from one Engadget reader, which was like, what does geofencing it even mean in this situation? What are the, like, where is it that CSAM is legal, right? There's like probably no country where this is like a reasonable thing for a AI bot to be able to do, right?
Like, it was a garbage statement of them like being like not even acknowledging it took so long to fix this. I think it's somewhere they're like, oh yeah, we take this issue very seriously. No, you don't. You spent weeks not doing shit. Because they knew, kind of, essentially Musk knew, like, at least nobody in the U.S. government would really touch him because he is buddy-buddy with all of this. It is very weird how this whole administration and the people associated with them basically became the pedophile protection ring. That's kind of where we are right now. Very hard thing to explain to people. Yeah,
and you know, the scary part of this is like the same week, you know, the Defense Department announced it was partnering with XAI to use Grok as like one of the chatbots, and that they would like expedite how quickly Grok could harvest all of the US like unclassified data. And it's just like, this is, you know, and I mean, this is, you know, something that I...
To that I say,
But this is, so when we talk about AI, this is why I'm like immediately skeptical of a lot of these features and a lot of these companies, because at the heart of it, they don't care. They just want the engagement. They want people to gleefully create these things. Certainly Elon Musk did not care about these things happening. And we do need more people just saying no to AI features like this, or straight to jail. If you are enabling a CSAM thing, like there was a big push for users on social media to like go to the app store and report X as an app that's generating CSAM, and Apple wouldn't touch it. Apple did not really respond or do anything with it. Really? I've seen apps get thrown off the app store for nothing. For the bare, like, remember what happened with Tumblr back in the day? Like, because they had like vague consensual pornography or nude images. You're seeing
it was not vague.
Yeah, no, it was not vague, but it was also like, you're seeing the hypocrisy of everybody kind of involved here. It's infuriating.
But there is like the guy who runs X and Grok also has Brendan Carr on speed dial. That's the big thing.
He was also the guy to call everybody a pedo so quickly. But anyway, before we annoy him too much in the we just want to point out that this is happening. X has finally said something about it, but don't forget. I think that's why it's good to bring up this news. Do not forget all the injustices and indignities these companies have, you know, basically committed against our society. It's good to remember it, and this is also why we're very skeptical about AI things. What's that, Ben?
Then we have one more bit of pure AI news, which I saw just last night. The startup Cursor, which is... correct me if I'm wrong, Igor, one of the new unicorns of this AI boom.
That's a good way to describe
it. Says that they got a bunch of AI agents to write 1 million lines of code worth of like a web browser from scratch. It took the agents almost a week nonstop of work. How do you feel about this?
Well, let me tell you. So in Slack yesterday, we shared this study that it was like kind of looking at the value of actual AI work. And right. And what it found was that a lot of, you know, for every 10 hours, I believe, of AI work, 4 has to be spent kind of fixing it. And it was really interesting looking at the difference between what like my coworkers thought and then what my friends who are both coders thought. And, you know, they're just... they're like in a state where they believe their industry is done, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, they were telling me about their company is not hiring junior devs anymore, right? So that basically eliminates any opportunity for them to move up the ladder, right? And this, I think, you know, for it's just a sign that these systems are getting better. And I think like, for coding especially, like I think I understand the kind of fear that is among coders that, like, I think they're, you know, their industry, like, kind of, it overhired in a way and, like, grew too quickly, and it was presented at this, you know, silver bullet. Like, I remember the heyday where it was, like, all these, like, coding camps, right? And they're like, this
is how you... And people were getting hired from coding camps with, like, not that much experience, but getting hired to well-paying positions because they could do a bit of coding. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, 0 to 200K within a year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, coding, you know, for all its faults, you know, of these industry, it was a way for people to get into the middle class, right? And I think, you know, Dev and I have spoken about this before, like, AI is not a productivity technology, it's a way of deflating wages, right? And I think this is just a sign that, like, you know, this one avenue for people to, you know, earn money and make a living is probably soon going to close, right? And that's really scary, right? Like, you know, so it's just I think it's a bad sign, right? Like, for as impressive as the technology is, right? And obviously Cursor says there's still a lot they need to figure out, but, like, they say at the bottom, like, optimistically, you know, the answer to can a team of agents do this? The answer is optimistic, right?
I also thought it was kind of interesting that in the little video they had in this research post, they literally just showed the websites being rendered.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't click around on the websites. Mm-hmm. They didn't go from one website to the other.
Mm-hmm.
That makes me go,
There's a lot of things there. But
yeah.
Okay. We'll be following this. Yeah.
Igor, when you say that avenue as, like, you know, an easy way toward an office job, an easy way toward the middle class, are you saying that that window is closing for everyone, including the people who, I know some folks who went through coding boot camps and now they have, you know, 6 or 7 years as experience as a developer? Is that window closing for them as well, or are you saying that AI has pulled the ladder up for anyone trying to get into this field?
Yeah, so my friend described it in a really great way, which, you know, I think the coding industry will become more like the journalism industry, mm-hmm. in the sense that there will be fewer jobs.
Don't say that. Dying, yeah.
Right? Like, it'll be, you know, like, if you're in a job right now and, you know, you're one of the lucky ones, but it might be kind of a situation where if you lose your job, it may take like a year or more for you to find a new position. And for some people, that will be tenable, but for many, it won't be, right?
This is where I recommend people go check out Park Chan Wook's new movie, No Other Choice, which is about a paper salesman who is having a hard time getting rehired and goes on to make some decisions. Hey, capitalism is crushing all of us right now. And that movie is such a great reflection of that. Yeah. But anyway, okay, so it's going to not be great for coders. I'm seeing a lot of coders gleefully saying, like, oh, yeah, my AI assistant is helping me out. It's really making me work faster. People are talking about vibe coding their way to new apps and stuff. There is a cost. The cost to it is the potential destruction of the entire field of programming. So don't get too excited about it, folks. Yeah.
Also, I've seen people say that it's a really easy way to, like, you could start your own business. You can start your own something, just like, you know, vibe coding their own apps. But if everyone is a founder, everybody's still poor.
Oh, man. What a mess. Let's move on to some stuff from around the gadget. There's a good story I wanted to highlight by Will Shanklin, titled It's Time for Apple to Reinstate IceBlock. And hey, making some good points, because we are seeing what's happening with ICE and how it's basically directly attacking American civilians, and especially after the killing of Renee Nicole Good by an ICE agent captured on video. It sort of, like, galvanized everybody against ICE. ICE Block was this app that people were using to basically track the movement of ICE around their towns and everything. I think Will makes some very good arguments here. It's also like, it's interesting that Apple took that down because they thought it was a dangerous thing for ICE agents. The subhead here, the danger isn't to ICE officers. The danger is ICE officers, says Will Shanklin. Check out that piece. I think he makes some very good points. And good luck to everybody out there protesting right now. Anything we want to mention, folks, before we wrap up? Like, what are you working on, Igor, at this point?
I just have, so I'll have an article. I think it'll go up today, depending on whether Congress passes an appropriations bill that'll fund some of the government, and it covers NASA funding. And it's from, there's at least a bit of good news there in that the agency won't be completely eviscerated, as has been the strategy from the Trump administration. So look out for that. I'm really proud of it. And yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. I will definitely be, I'm trying to get my hands on some new Intel laptops, some of the new laptops by the, the chips with the new core graphics. Like, that's what I'm really interested in seeing. I saw a demo of it running Battlefield 6 on like a freaking ultra portable, and it did pretty well. So yeah, looking to test those machines more fully. Yeah.
If I can just say, like, Intel, you know, they have the opportunity of a lifetime to save the GPU industry from NVIDIA, and mm-hmm. they just need to take it, you know, like, just get the marketing people out of the way and just, you know, use 18A. It is such an incredible process from all accounts. You know, like, I think this company just needs a bit of vision for once in its life.
And what they essentially did was like, what if we just put a shit ton of GPUs in this chip? What if we just put a ton of GPU cores in here and let's see what happens? It seems like it's going to be pretty good for gaming, but we will report back in a bit. Anything you guys want to mention in terms of pop culture picks this week?
I think just, you know, as a Canadian, I don't try to comment too much on, like, it's not really my place to comment on politics, but, you know, my partner and I, just our heart goes out to everyone in Minneapolis and every other city that is being affected. You know, it's just really, people are just trying to go about their daily lives. And, you know, like, I wish there was more I could do to help them, you know.
It's rough out here in America. It's a strange time we're living through right now. But anyway, my pick would be, hey, if you can, pick out the theater to see No Other Choice. Park Chan-wook is back and making a sort of like Black Succumb that is just so perfect to our time. I forget if I talked about it here before. I'm also catching up on Fallout. And hey, I didn't finish Fallout Season 1, but if you want some good sci-fi TV, that's real good. I've seen a bit of Starfleet Academy. That's also like, I'm having a lot of fun with it. We have a review up on the site. And Engadget's Dan Cooper disagrees and thinks it's a bad show. And I think Dan is wrong. Sorry, Dan.
Dan hates all new Star Trek.
Trek. That's just very common.
It's true.
Yeah.
That's something.
It's very consistent.
He does these posts talking about how all the new Star Trek is bad.
I mean, there are things to like. But anything you want to shout out, Igor?
I've been playing, I'm like 7 years late to this, but I bought RE2 and RE4 remake on the Steam sales. And, like, let me just say that, Reach for the Moon engine, chef's kiss.
Good
like,
stuff. Good stuff. Yeah.
It's good. So I can't wait for RE9 now and Pragmata. So I'm really excited to see what like Capcom does with like, you know, both games have path tracing. Not that many people will have GPUs that can do it, but you know, like I'm really excited to see the implementation, you know, like, and Pragmata is like an entirely new franchise for them, so that's gonna be fun.
Awesome. I wish like I keep buying or downloading survival horror games and I just like lose interest so quickly, but I gotta finish up some of these, at least the RE4 remake.
Thanks everybody for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Igor online at
Igor Bonifacic at Blue Sky.
You can find Devendra online at
I'm at Devendra on Blue Sky, and also a podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to tell me about other good games that you've gotten to 7 or 8 years late, you can find me on Blue Sky at Hey Bellman. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes, because I promise you it helps. And subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.
Thanks, folks. We're out.